Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Danny Fenster is one of the lucky ones. He was jailed for 6 months in Myanmar after the military enacted a coup last year. Fenster was able to return home to the U.S., and now he's back to doing what he loves, reporting. But so many other reporters, often local reporters, languish behind bars in autocratic countries. It's a problem to this day in Myanmar and in so many other parts of the world. So what can we learn from Danny Fenster's story? And what's he trying to do now to pay it forward? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Let's cue that music. I first heard the name Danny Fenster soon after he was taken into custody at the international airport. He was trying to leave Myanmar. He was trying to head home to see his family in Detroit. But instead, he was thrown behind bars, not knowing for how long or really even why. Fenster was a journalist in Myanmar before the coup. He worked for a publication called Myanmar Now and then joined Frontier Myanmar in August 2020. And that's important because of what you're about to hear about why he thinks the authorities came after him. It's also important to recognize as you hear his story, that he had help, he had support. His parents, his family, they came on programs like Reliable Sources to advocate for his release. And his wife, Juliana, she was in Myanmar, and she was able to support him on the ground, sometimes bringing him packages. She was able to receive notes that he would slip and sneak to her. It's an incredible personal story about one journalist thrown behind bars, treated to a sham trial, but then able to find freedom in a way that, frankly, other journalists sometimes are not. You're going to hear at the end of this interview how it's connected to the war in Ukraine as well. There's a lot to get to. So let me present to you the interview in full, my conversation with Danny Fenster. Hey, Danny, I'm so glad we're able to talk. I was worried last spring that maybe we would never be able to speak.
Yeah. I'm also extremely happy we can finally talk. When I got out of there, you know, the first time I was able to see all the media coverage and realize people have been following. And, you know, I saw my family on your show. So I wanted to say thank you so much for consistently covering this.
Well, look, when this happens, when a journalist is behind bars and it's in a repressive regime, you know, I feel like we're all just shouting into the void. You never know if the coverage has any impact. So it's interesting to hear you say that when you get out, you then look back and you think, wow, people actually did know about my situation. People actually were paying attention.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I'm certainly not an expert, but I mean, there's a lot of, you know, people have different strategic ideas about how they should go about this sort of hostage situation. Journalists or other Americans detained, whether publicity helps or not. And I think it's going to matter who the regime is that you're dealing with and who the captors are. Yeah. But I know that for me, I mean, as a journalist, but I think just otherwise as a person, I think like knowing that other people are aware of it, I mean, it made everything much more meaningful. I was able to make a lot more meaning out of the whole thing once I got out. And I do genuinely think it helped. I don't think the resources that came to bear on my situation would have been attracted to it without so much coverage.
Well, let's start with what you were there to do, not with you getting thrown behind bars, not this awful, ordeal. But why did you want to go to Myanmar in the first place?
Well, I mean, I think early on, in terms of writing and journalism, I had become obsessed with George Orwell at a pretty young age, and mostly his nonfiction. And he wrote a lot about his time in Burma, as it was called. And that got me interested. And it was around that same time that my brother and I, we were both living in Chicago, and we had started volunteering with a group that helped refugees from around the world that were resettling in Chicago. And some of the families we were volunteering with, and one family in particular that we became very close with, were from Myanmar. They were from the Chin ethnic minority. There's a very diverse country with a lot of different ethnic and linguistic groups. And that just made me even more fascinated. So for about a decade or something, all these things were just in the back of my mind. And at I hit a certain age and thought I was like, you know, if I don't move abroad and do this whole thing about wanting to be a foreign reporter, foreign correspondent, then it may never happen. And it also at the time, you know, it was a couple of years before the 2020 election. It seemed like this was an interesting story, that there was one free election. This was a really big test to see how sustainable some of these reforms had been. It was an interesting story. And then the entire thing collapsed on February 1st last year.
Were you ever in danger before February, before the military coup, or did it all happen quickly?
It all happened extremely quickly. And it's funny, like I never felt like I was in that much danger. I had a lot of friends that were Western journalists that I was an editor, and I was editing a local English language, but local outlet. So I wasn't getting bylines, right? I found a lot of meaning in what I came to think of my role as was helping locals tell their story to an international audience because of, you know, my editing and language skills, because of the training and journalism and the norms of it. You know, you can act as this conduit for locals to tell their story. So I had kind of thought, you know, I'm in the background, I'm peripheral. And I had a lot of friends that were more prominent on social media, getting bylines in bigger papers. And I was one of the last of my friends to leave the country. And we'd all watch as somebody went to the airport to leave, kind of holding our breath. And certain people that have just been there forever, that are real experts on the place, that have written really daring things. We watched them leave one by one, and it just seemed very safe.
When did that change? Exactly.
Well, so, immediately once we heard that the military had seized power in a coup, on February 1st, you kind of wonder. There weren't any explicit threats or anything, but then everyone starts wondering, how is this going to be for journalists? And it slowly started getting worse and worse, but they were largely targeting local reporters. And, any escalation for me personally in terms of worry or fear, there was none until I was at the gate. The boarding gate, and all of a sudden a group of police came in and said they were looking for Daniel Fenster.
So for you, it was a split second where your entire life changed.
Yeah, basically. And it didn't even set in. That entire day, I didn't think this was going to last very long. And then for another week or two, I didn't think it was going to last very long. There's a real reluctance for me to realize what was happening.
So you tried to get to the airport, tried to get out.
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't necessarily want to leave the country, but it was getting harder and harder to report. I hadn't seen my family in a few years. I wanted to come back to Detroit, Michigan to see my family. So that was the plan. Because my wife is a diplomat, we thought, I hadn't registered as the partner of a diplomat before, but we thought when I come back, I'll register that way and come back with that sort of visa. In that passport, and it might allow me to stay longer than anybody else that's there. But obviously that plan didn't work out.
Take us through the airport experience.
Take you through the airport. Yeah. Well, we were driving to the airport. This was May. So there were, you know, plenty of soldiers on the street. That was kind of normal. Got to the airport, you check in at a security gate where there's sort of armed guards. They take the taxi driver's ID. This is from memory, so, you know, with that caveat, they take the taxi driver's ID. Taxi goes in and drops us off. And then when he leaves, they give him back his ID. It was very, very strictly controlled by then. But then I got to the airport. I went through security. I checked in, went through customs. They stamped my passport. In my passport, there's still a stamp with that date, May 24th, as my exit date. And then it's voided out. And then, you know, I was at the boarding area. I was at the gate waiting to board and texting Juliana. Look, it's not all good. You know, I'll see you in Detroit. She was going to follow me there. Yeah, all good. I'll see you in Detroit. And then out of nowhere, I'm sitting there in a group of maybe 8 police officers, maybe half of them uniformed, half of them not. They just walked through the crowd to the ticket, to the lady at the boarding gate, and said they were looking for Daniel Jacob Fenster. And I was just like pretty shocked. I just kind of like shyly like raised my hand. It seemed really surreal, but it just didn't seem like anything serious was about to happen, because I just didn't. It just seemed so absurd and so crazy that they were looking for me.
Right. So you didn't think to run, partly because there was nowhere to run and partly because you didn't think they were actually going to throw you behind bars.
Yeah. Both. Both were definitely the case. And then, they escorted me to a side area and just started interrogating me for just hours.
What do you think was the trigger or the tripwire? Like, what actually caused them to ensnare you?
Yeah, well, as far as I know, and I'm fairly confident that this is what happened. I edit at a magazine called Frontier Myanmar, and it's primarily English language. Prior to that, in 2020, I worked at an outlet called Myanmar Now. And that is a primarily Myanmar language outlet, but there's some English features also. And it's investigative and it's very confrontational and very anti-military. And I had written some stories about military-owned businesses and protests against them and sort of, you know, that sort of thing. And my byline was on those. But that was all in 2020 before the coup. And that was all legal. There were no charges or anything. Mm. Once the military came in, they started revoking media licenses, shutting down publications, and raiding newsrooms. And they raided the Myanmar Now newsroom, and I already was at another outlet, but my name was on some documents there. And I think this military is like quite incompetent. I don't think they know exactly what they're doing or what their goals are, who they're looking for. And I think they found that name and just assumed that maybe I could lead them to others that they were looking for. I really think they had no idea. I think it was a big mistake on their part. And then they found themselves in this situation.
Stuck and not wanting to admit they were wrong and just holding you then for months and months. But in the beginning, when you're in the airport and then you're being taken away and you're being interrogated, you have no idea how long this is going to go on. So when did it begin to sink in that this was going to be a long-term ordeal?
Oh, man. Well, it's hard to, I'm trying to write all this down, but it's difficult to piece together the exact timeline. For a while, I had a notebook and a calendar, but at a certain point, they took all that. Mm. But within, I think, 3 or 4 weeks, I realized that they were going through with this trial. The legal system is absurd, it's a joke. But they were going to go through this trial, and I was talking to others in prison about the process, and it just drags on for so long. I think by the time I had a court hearing, I realized that this might take, I thought, 2 or 3 months. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to be here for 2 or 3 months. I'll just kind of accept that. And that's when I kind of thought it'd be long term. After 2 or 3 months, about the 3 month mark, when I realized that there was no progress being made and that it was just a political negotiation, then I thought, wow, I might be here for a year, several years. I'm really not sure.
And what were the conditions? You said you had a calendar and then it was taken away. What did you have? Did you have anything else?
I mean, I had books. So I'm like, you know, a lot more aware now of other journalists that have gone through situations like this that generally are a lot worse, I think, than I had it. There's a guy, Theo Padnos, I think was taken in Syria, miraculously made it out. Several others, I think Jason Rezaian at the Washington Post, I don't think he was allowed to have books, but I was allowed to have books. That changed everything. That made it bearable. The physical conditions are kind of, you know, I think any human will get used to the physical conditions at a certain point, but, you know, you have the sort of cognitive experience, the mental experience. And that's the really the only thing that becomes difficult. But the physical conditions were, you know, like a 9x7 concrete cell, a small outdoor communal area. You could kind of pace around a trough of water that you'd sort of use for washing dishes and dumping a bucket over yourself for showers. You know, the meals weren't great. The meals were, you kind of adapt to those too, and you start thinking they're not that bad. But I had, Juliana was bringing me packages of food and books once every 2 weeks. And she would bring fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, you know, things that were getting me through it. Sometimes a little bit of candy, snacks and things.
I think I would have been fearing for her as well. Fearing that if they can do this to you, they can do this to her too.
Yeah. Every time, I mean, I was never able to see her and I wasn't really talking to her when she would arrive at the prison. But every time she'd come to the prison, I was worried that something had happened, that something would happen. The entire time we were there, I mean, she didn't have to stay in Yangon. She could have, you know, gone back to Brazil. It was not easy to stay. There was a wave of very devastating COVID. There's ongoing fighting and resistance to the military rule. She was terrified the entire time that she was being watched, that maybe they would raid her house. It was terrifying. I, at one time, I found ways to sneak notes out. And one time I had a friend in the prison who she had sent in a book. So I had given this friend the book. He was getting out on bail. So I gave him the book and I gave him our address in Yangon. And I told him to deliver the book with a note in it. So he brought it back to her. He just knocked on the door and she must have opened the door there in Yangon and seen a guy standing there with the book that she had sent to me. Mm. And I'm sure that was a terrifying experience. It ended up being great because she read the note and, you know, felt connected and everything and found out some information. But like, yeah, she's just going through all of these experiences. My parents also, my brother and my parents. I think days after I was arrested, the New York Times did a feature on the notorious insane prison and what goes on there. I wasn't able to talk to them for about a month, so that all they could do was speculate.
That's true. In the press, we kept referring to the prison as notorious. Mm-hmm. You're actually suggesting it could have been even worse, that you've heard horror stories from other journalists in other countries, and you actually feel, it sounds to me like you feel like you were actually in a little bit of a better situation.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think part of that is just being a Westerner. I think there's a lot of advantages and privileges that come with that. I think they were a little bit afraid to treat me too terribly. They would arrest people. They interrogate them outside of the prison, off-site, and then they would drop them off. And there were guys in my area that were had clearly gone through traumatic torture experiences, guys that were uncommunicative and just pacing, and you know, others that told me they had been tortured and didn't really want to tell me anymore, or didn't want to talk more about it. So I didn't experience any of that firsthand.
Were there any other journalists in the group that you were with, some of these locals who had been rounded up and arrested before you?
Yeah, early on, there was a group of them in my area, and actually one of them who I had worked with before and knew pretty well. We were really excited to see each other in there. It was like a you know, really nice, surprising reunion. And I think as soon as they saw us embrace and they saw us talking all day, they moved all of them to another ward and kind of kept me isolated.
I've asked Jason Rezaian and others like about this in the past. When you're behind bars, when you're in detention, you don't know how long you're going to be in. Do you try to take notes? Do you treat it like a reporting assignment, like the reporting assignment from hell? Or does that part of you go away?
Yeah. No, not at all. It intensifies. It's funny. It's a great question. I've come out of the experience, and I think a lot of people were worried if I'd be traumatized, if, you know, something, how my mental health was. And I seem to be, you know, doing very well. For, I think there's a number of reasons for that. But my wife said, you know, I think what happened was you got in there and you immediately thought, okay, I'm a reporter. This is really interesting. Nobody else, no other Western journalists have this view or this experience. And I just went into reporter mode. So there's almost a reason or a meaning to be there. And when the first phone call I had with her and with my parents, I told them, you know, listen, don't worry. It's, you know, I'm doing okay. You know, I said the words, I'm chilling. Don't worry about me. And she said afterwards, when we've been talking about it now, she's like, I think it's because you went into that reporter mode. And I was taking lots of notes. and writing down a lot of things and sketching things. And that added, I think, to the sense of like, okay, that something will come up, something decent will come out of this. And then I got caught maybe 3 months into it, trying to sneak notes out to Juliana. And when they found me sneaking notes out, then they really cracked down. They raided the cell. They took every piece of paper, every pen, and all of a sudden pen and paper became like extreme contraband for this one prisoner. It was like, do not let him touch a pen.
I think that would be the point I would lose hope. Was there a point of that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. It was that. It was terrible. It was awful. And I was thinking I've just gotten in trouble, so they're going to keep me here longer. And I started thinking like, well, if I'm going to stay here, let's say I'm going to stay here for 3 years. If I'm going to stay here for 3 years, I need to negotiate with them to have a notebook. We can keep it at the ward superintendent guy's office. Let's just leave it there. And, it, you know, when I want to write something, I'll go there. They can monitor it. They can let me write things down for an hour a day, 2 hours a day. If I can negotiate that, maybe it'll be manageable. But I couldn't. If I had to stay for that much longer without being able to write anything down, I think I would have gone nuts.
Hmm. Let me just squeeze in a quick break. More with Danny Fenster in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter. We're in the middle of my conversation with Danny Fenster about being detained for nearly 6 months in Myanmar. So let's just go ahead and pick right up where we left off. So getting us to the point, Danny, where you have a taste of freedom when you're actually able to get out of Myanmar. When did you start to have a sense that something was happening diplomatically, that there were negotiations, that you might have a chance to get out? When did that begin to be clear?
Well, on and off throughout the process, while I was in prison, I had sporadic access to phone calls with the embassy, to my consular representative there, and they were assuring me that they were doing everything they could. And I was talking to my brother, and my brother was telling me all the things that he was trying to do. So I knew there were negotiations going on. I knew that in Myanmar, everything is decided by one person, and that it's going to be up to him and that people are lobbying and negotiating with him. But I didn't know any of the details of what was happening. Maybe a couple weeks before I was released, we were getting state newspapers. There's a central covered pavilion in our ward. And when we get these state newspapers delivered a couple days late, and it was just the government line, government propaganda. But in a couple weeks before that, Bill Richardson had appeared on the front page of the paper talking to Myanmar's number one, Min Aung Hlaing. And everybody around me was like, oh, this is really good news. You know, I'm sure they're talking about you.
Look, this was clearly a sham trial. There's no other way to describe it. And yet there was still hope for you thanks to the diplomatic efforts.
Yeah. It was a sham trial. You know, it's a funny thing. Early on in the trial, I said I had a lawyer. And I said to the lawyer, look, it was kind of understood. They've arrested you. They need to find you guilty so that they can't say that they've wrongly held you this long. They'll find you guilty and then kick you out. And I said to the attorney early on, if that's the case, let's just plead guilty.
Yeah.
Let's just plead guilty and they'll call me guilty and then they'll send me home.
Right.
He said, no, there's a phrase in Myanmar, in courts, in the legal system in Myanmar. It's like, you know, we're making a movie. So when you go to court, it's like action. And everyone's playing this part and it's all show and everybody knows that.
Wow.
It's like we have to go through the process. They have to listen to these absurd witnesses. Hmm. And then they'll find you guilty. So that was kind of the thing. But the court was so slow and it kept getting shut because of COVID. A witness wouldn't show up and they'd postpone it for another couple of weeks. But by the end, after that Bill Richardson thing was on the state newspaper, it went from that to once a week to every day from like 9 to 5 the entire day. And they just started zooming through it.
Mm. So they got what they wanted. They had their so-called trial. But then Richardson is able to come to Myanmar and escort you home. That might have been your first time on a private jet. It must have been so disorienting to have this moment of freedom. And I wonder, as you're taking off, are you thinking about the other journalists and the other, you know, residents, just the ordinary civilians caught in the middle of this coup? Are you thinking about them? Are you feeling guilt? What are the feelings as you're flying away?
Well, I mean, I to be completely honest, like I was just so happy, so overjoyed. And I was really, really kind of savoring it. And on the plane were a couple people with the Richardson Foundation. And, you know, we were talking about the process and they were kind of just explaining that to me. But I knew flying out of there didn't change anything that was happening in Myanmar and on the ground. And that awareness was there. And as time has gone on, I mean, the balance of those two feelings, those two emotions, my joy of being free and this thing ending, but the weight of sort of responsibility or just sort of the sympathy I have for the people that are still there. I mean, there are a lot of different subgroups of people. So there are a lot of young kids that were protesting. There are a lot of journalists that are there. There's also people that have gotten caught up in the Myanmar legal system before the coup that are just stuck there languishing. There was a young guy who ran a karaoke bar, and it was open during COVID restrictions. And if he had been found guilty, it came with a 3-month sentence. But he had already been there for 10 months because the courts were closed and they kept postponing his trial.
Oh.
There was another person in there who had been on trial for 3 years. Person who accused him of the crime no longer lives in the country and has not returned to the country to come to the court to act as a witness. So every 2 weeks, they just tell him, go back to your cell and we'll try again. There are non-Myanmar citizens from countries that don't have embassies there, from countries that are not as wealthy and well-resourced, that are just stuck there. They have no legal representation. They have no consular representation. There's a lot of people in insane prison that are just languishing there unjustly. And I think about it constantly.
Is that partly why you recently returned to the region? You were in Thailand reuniting with old colleagues who are trying to cover Myanmar from the outside. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a big reason. I as I was kind of saying, like, I had this idea that I wanted to stay in Myanmar, but it seemed like it was becoming impossible to do any reporting. So I was going home to visit family. But in the back of my mind was, in February 2022, Juliana's term would end in Myanmar. She'll go back to Brazil. I'll follow her. We'll go to her next posting. Maybe I'm wrapping things up in Myanmar. I'd been there for a couple of years. And this experience just made me feel extremely tied to the country, extremely tied to my team at Frontier. The publisher of the magazine, Sonny Sway, just an incredible guy. He spent nearly 10 years in Myanmar prisons as a political prisoner. The guy I worked for at Myanmar Now, Sway Win, he spent 10 years in insane prison before I worked for him. Every journalist there has gone through this experience. And I just feel a lot more connected to the entire media landscape there, to the entire country.
Does it also make you think differently about the freedoms that we have in the U.S. and the freedoms that are in democratic countries?
Well, it does make you aware of, I don't think I ever took any of those things for granted. You know, I mean, I went into journalism for a reason, and I've always found this ability to storytelling and sort of issue analysis in a free and open way, and the importance of criticism. I've always held that very dear. So it isn't like a thing that I had never thought about. But I mean, it does make you realize that, okay, that's not actually the case everywhere. And no matter where you see signs of progress at home or out in the world, it's always possible. These things are always somewhat fragile. They can always be taken back and there can be declines. And I think that's kind of a global trend right now. We're seeing this happen in various places. Now, I'll tell you an interesting anecdote. In the prison, we had a flat screen TV in that public pavilion. And immediately after the coup, before I was there, they cut the BBC, they cut CNN, they cut access to all independent channels, and it was only state media. On the state media, they would have the newscasts, and they would also have entertainment stuff, and it was sort of quasi-educational programming, a lot of Chinese action movies, and a lot of Indian sort of Bollywood dance films. And around the time in late June, we started seeing splashed across the front pages of the papers, Russian defense officials coming to Myanmar, Min Aung Hlaing touring them around the facilities where they've confiscated these, you know, slingshots and homemade guns.
Oh.
Like, this is the threat that they're up against, you know. And then a couple weeks later, Myanmar defense officials are going to Russia to look at weapon systems and to buy helicopters. And within a couple of weeks, squeezed in between the Chinese and Indian films, we're starting to get these Russian gangster flicks. I mean, it's not coincidental. These regimes, you know, once Russia invaded Ukraine, both of these countries have a long history of suppressing dissent. So I don't want to overstate this, but as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, you saw so many similar tactics. Myanmar, they banned in media the use of the word coup, the use of the word junta. They said, this is a caretaker government, you must call it that. In Russia, they banned the use of the word war and invasion. They've shut down media, you know, license. They've revoked media license, shut down newspapers in both countries. They're trying to, you know, impose these bans on the internet.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just remarkably similar to watch it play out. And one thing I think that Western countries make a mistake in is like, RT is this sort of, it can be used as this Russian state propaganda. Banning it in European countries in the West, I don't think is the answer. I mean, that stuff is so on its face, obviously unconvincing. Just like in Myanmar, the state media, I don't think anybody really buys into it. Banning it just isn't, you know, the right thing to do. So I think that goes both ways. But obviously, it's much more intensive bans in Myanmar and Russia.
Yeah. I'm so thankful you're able to tell us this story and to share what you've learned.
Yeah, no, thank you. And, you know, I would say one more thing, if I can.
Please.
People in Myanmar, I think they've been watching the world's reaction to Ukraine and Russia. And most people understand the reason that governments have responded the way that they've responded, especially superpowers. The context is different. It's an invasion from outside. It's issues of sovereignty. It's close to NATO borders. But the reaction of individuals, the overwhelming support that people have shown, everyone has shown the people of Ukraine, is incredibly inspiring. And I think people in Myanmar, you know, they're fleeing. And because they've been a poorer country than even their neighbors in Southeast Asia, they face a lot of discrimination when they are living in exile now. They haven't seen the welcome embrace that people in Ukraine have. And I think, you know, Countries have reasons for responding. Governments have reasons for responding differently. And media coverage has reasons for covering it more extensively also for some of those same reasons. And I think everyone understands that. But the response of individuals, I think, has been really frustrating. If you're keeping focused on Myanmar and watching that. So it's just something that's kind of been on my mind that I've wanted to sort of say.
Yeah, it's a really important note. And it's also a challenge to journalists. An opportunity for journalists.
It is.
To pursue the story.
It is. It is. You know, I think, you know, there's something about news coverage where it is kind of zero sum. When you're covering one thing, you're not covering another thing. And that's just a reality. But I don't think compassion is zero sum. I think we can help people in all these different situations. And for us, for journalists, I mean, I think it's just it's the challenge for us to make this story more compelling and to get it out there more often in new ways. While whatever else is going on in the world is going on.
Well said. Danny, thank you again. Good talking with you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for everything. Thanks for having my brother on earlier and everything. Thank you.
Absolutely. And thanks for joining us here for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. We'll see you on television this Sunday, every Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. And then weekdays at 11 a.m. on Reliable Sources Daily on CNN Plus. Thanks for tuning in.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.